to Straight Talk with MJ. I'm your host, Michelle Jeanette, and today we're going to continue our talking on I'm going there. The last podcast episode, I did go there a little bit on the issue of the candidates and where they stand on gun control, and I didn't really finish some of the points that I wanted to make because I realized I was going a little long, so I had to make this two separate podcast episodes. But we were talking about the gun issue, the Second Amendment issue, and where the candidates stand on gun control legislation or ideas that they have. And of course, one of the big proponents of gun control is Mike Bloomberg, who has a huge group. It's a couple of different anti-gun groups, if you want to call it that. But he's given millions and billions of dollars to different mayors around the country and different groups and people who will support gun control issues and ideas. And the one big result that you saw was in Virginia. We talked about that and how he poured $2.5 million into Virginia. And it worked, it flipped blue, and you can see the result. They are going full force trying to subvert the Constitution and restrict law-abiding citizens with their guns. And fortunately, a few Democrats came to their senses, at least for this year, and did not pass. They did not get past the bill for a banning things like AR-15, what they call assault weapons, and they really can't define what an assault weapon is. The other thing I wanted to point out, too, when he was talking about Bernie Sanders and Mike Bloomberg and some others, they were talking about, you know, you don't want to be able to buy guns online. Well, you can't buy a gun online and have it shipped to your house. Okay, they have to ship it to a federally licensed firearm dealer who then, when you go to get it, has to do a background check. So, again, that's what that does. And the supposed gun show loophole, what they're trying to close there, who it's really going to harm, it's not going to do a thing to criminals. Because that's not how they get them, okay? what it does, it's going to punish people like maybe the grandpa that wants to hand down his rifle to a grandson or teach him how to shoot or hunt or teach him, you know, hand things down to a family member. And so that kind of law would punish the law-abiding people. It's just how it works. So that they talk a good talk, and when you don't really know the facts, you think, oh, that sounds good. You know, like the background checks. We have the background checks if they would be used properly, okay? If they would use them properly, and we talked about how they were not in my last episode, so go and listen to that. The other thing is criminals, you know, do they really go and get their guns at a gun show? I don't think so. They don't go get their guns. Have you been to a gun show? Okay. That's just a crazy idea. Anyway, so that was kind of what we talked about yesterday. And it's kind of ironic that Mike Bloomberg wants to restrict your access to tools that will help you defend yourself against whatever. And then he goes on and walks around with his, how many people does he have in his entourage of bodyguards who are armed? So I don't have the money to go hire a bodyguard. So how is that going to work? Yeah, it doesn't work. So I just, you know, we were talking about the guns. So I wanted to bring that little tidbit up to you. About that and finish that topic off. The next issue, which is kind of interesting because it's kind of in the news. A lot of people are talking about it because Bernie Sanders is surging in the polls and in the caucuses. He won Nevada, and they had another debate last night. And I did watch a little bit of it, but it was interesting to watch. They're all about restricting your gun rights. They sure are. They want everybody to know that. But because Bernie Sanders is ahead, seems to be pushing ahead, brings the topic of socialism to the forefront. We've kind of skimmed over it a little bit. Of course, the news media hasn't really talked about it, but it's a huge thing because I don't know if they want Bernie to win or not, and who knows if he pulls this off, if they will let him win. You know how it kind of was stolen from him the last presidential election, so we'll see. We'll see. But if he is going to win this nomination, you have to understand who he is and what he stands for and what America would become if he was president. And it's not just him, because everybody wants to label him because he's such a self-avowed, self-declared socialist, which is the same thing as communism. And I'm going to read a couple of articles that kind of touch on that issue. But, you know, if you look at the other candidates, they may not put it in the socialism nutshell basket, you know, in that category, but their issues and where they stand on them are pretty socialist in ideas, that kind of thing. So social, big government. The government is the answer to all the problems. None of them think that government should get out of the way, but they all think that government is the answer. More government in your healthcare, more government with regulations on guns, more government in insurance, more government in it, just all across the board. All right. And then it's just, that is socialism, government run entities, government run private business. They want to regulate and tell private businesses what to do. That is socialism in its ideas. And so that's what just about all the candidates for the Democrat side are. That's where they stand. But socialism, we hear that word kind of thrown around and you think, okay, what exactly is that? And the thing too about Bernie Sanders, and if you don't follow Intercessors for America, go to their website, ifapray.org. And it's a really good website for Christians to get notified on issues and they do prayer and how to pray for them. And it's important that we pray. I talked about that in the last episode, that one of the best ways that Christians can get involved, one of the first ways, is to pray. I mean, obviously we don't just pray, we have to act, but prayer, it starts with prayer. Okay, prayer for everybody. And I confess, I didn't always do that. I didn't always pray for my leaders. And the last few years, it's really, you know, been convicted of that. And so I've been praying more for my leaders, and even I need to keep doing more of that. But that's why I love IFA Pray, Intercessors for America, because they teach you that, or they give you little notifications and reminders to pray. And they had a little excerpt about Bernie Sanders and how he threatens religious freedom in America. And I had not thought about this before, because really socialism is taking God out and replacing it with government. And when you hear Trump always talk about in his rallies, you know, we worship God, not government. It's very true. We're not supposed to worship government, but this is what the Democratic platform has become, where they want to replace God with government. I mean, they even voted in 2012, they voted God out of their platform. I mean, that's just kind of insane to me, but that's how far we've come. And now here in, you know, 2020 election, Bernie Sanders is at the forefront, and the potential, the IFA little article, it says the potential for Bernie Sanders to be a presidential candidate for a major party and also therefore be elected president is the most serious threat to religious freedom in our nation from the executive branch we have may have ever had. And here's why. It says, to be sure, I don't know if God has a plan to continue advancing Bernie's supernaturally in order to accomplish his purposes, but either way, this is a major matter for prayer. And the person writing this is Jeremy Story. And he says, I am surprised how many younger Christians are unaware of his religious views and are actively supporting him. Christians may disagree on policy, but Bernie's views on whether Christians can actively follow Jesus' claims to exclusivity should be a matter that unites us all. And here's an example. During a Senate confirmation hearing meeting in 2017, Senator Sanders was talking to Russell Vought, a nominee for deputy director of the Office of Management and Budget. And he said Mr. Vought was unqualified because he believes Jesus was the only way to God. And the senator's view was that because Mr. Vought thought Muhammad's teachings were not an equal way to God, he should not serve in the U.S. government. His closing statement is, this nominee is what this country is supposed to be about. And so he basically was saying that because he was a strong Christian, he didn't belong in a government position. That's pretty scary. This is an extremely dangerous and unconstitutional opinion. The core faith tenet of Christianity is that Jesus is the way, the truth, and life, and that no one gets to the Father but through him. Bernie Sanders basically declared all Christians who adhere to historical biblical Christianity as unfit to serve in our government. So that's kind of interesting. That is maybe people don't really think about that when they think of Bernie Sanders. So maybe I just why I wanted to bring this to the forefront and let you know where he stands on certain issues. And yesterday I did a live video really quick because there was a vote in the Senate yesterday on whether on two bills. One was the Paying Capable Act to try and not have abortions, to talk and debate about not having abortions after the child can feel pain, which is right now they have scientifically said at 20 weeks, and it has been proven that before that they've for some reason picked 20 weeks. And the other one was the Born Alive Act, which was saying that if a child did survive an abortion, that they had to give that child medical care. And both of those were up at the Senate. Both of those bills failed. I got on Facebook Live. I said, please call your senators. Tell them to vote for these bills. Senator Warren voted against it. Bernie Sanders voted against it. And the other candidates, some that had dropped out, Cory Booker for one, they voted. All the Democrats voted against these bills. This is where they stand. Now, why? I don't know. It's just beyond my comprehension why they can't protect a child after they've been born. Through a botched abortion, why they can't give medical care to that baby. They voted against it. So I just want to let you know where these Democrats stand on these issues, because this is what we're up against this election season. And we put all these issues in one place and look at where they really stand. It's kind of eye-opening. So I kind of wanted to bring that to you. And that's why I'm doing this, bringing these issues to the forefront in one little place for you to hear and kind of touch on them. Because I can go for hours talking about all this, but you know, I don't have that much time. But especially this week, next week starts the primaries, and it's important that we get out there and vote. Early voting ended yesterday for Tennessee because our Super Tuesday is coming up next Tuesday, March 3rd. So anyway, if you haven't early voted, at least go vote on March 3rd for the primaries for the president. And I think, you know, obviously there's different states have different other things that are being voted on for also. So that's the socialism thing. I did want to explain, because I have a really cool articles in the Epoch Times, and I've talked about the Epoch Times before. They have a newspaper that they send out once a week if you subscribe to them, and it's a really great newspaper. I love their articles, and they've been doing a series on communism. Let me grab that real quick. And they've talked about a series called How the Specter of Communism is Ruling Our World, and they're doing this specific issue had education. And they talked about, on this one, the moral relativism, the topic of moral relativism. And here's what an author, William Kilpatrick, he's an author of Why Johnny Can't Tell Right from Wrong. And he described such classes in the classroom, turned classroom discussions into bull sessions where opinions go back and forth, but conclusions are never reached. So this is how they started doing this in the late 70s. This is kind of in the classrooms. He said, it has resulted in classrooms where teachers act like talk show hosts, and where the merits of wife swapping, cannibalism, and teaching children different sexual things are recommended topics for debate. And for students, they don't say what's right or wrong. This is where I'm getting at. For students, it has meant wholesale confusion about moral values, learning to question values they have scarcely acquired, unlearning values taught at home, and concluding that questions of right and wrong are always merely subjective. It has created a generation of moral illiterates, students who know their own feelings but don't know their culture. And the scholar Thomas Sowell understood that these sessions utilized the same measures employed in totalitarian countries to brainwash people. They include things like emotional stress, shock, or desensitization to break down both intellectual and emotional resistance, isolation, whether physical or emotional. So, and he goes on and notes that the sessions are similar in that they encourage students to rebel from the traditional moral values taught by their parents and society. Classes were conducted in a neutral or non-judgmental way. In other words, the teacher does not distinguish between right and wrong, but searches for what feels good for an individual. They focus on the feelings of the individual rather than on the requirements of a functioning society or the requirements of an intellectual analysis. Woo! So when you talk about socialism, it's kind of, that's what it does. It teaches your kids, they unlearn what they've been taught. The traditional moral values at home are basic right and wrong. And they are replacing, they're putting this in their thoughts and in their minds that the parents are not right, that the teachers in the school and the government is right, and that the government replaces the parents and the government becomes God. They take right and wrong out, so they have to take God out of the equation, and the government becomes God. And, you know, this socialism, I had another article that's really good about the difference between, is communism and socialism different? You know, are they really that different? And the author, Diana West, said, as pundits trip over poli-sci class definitions, my question is, what's the difference? As far as freedom lovers go, safeguarding our liberties guaranteed by the Constitution, there is no difference between communism and socialism. To be sure, communists and socialists argue and split hairs. Yeah, they fight and break heads, but they also work together and destroy liberty because they all travel to the same soul-crushing destination of collectivism. That's their goal, collectivism. So what anti-communists, like conservatives, what they need to know is that communists and socialists and democratic socialists, progressives, Alinskyites, and not to mention most Democrats and even some Republicans, believe in the same centrally planned, varyingly totalitarian vision for America that our founding fathers would have had to declare independence from all over again. So, yeah, socialism is not anything close to what our founding fathers established this nation on. You know, the freedom, the individual liberty, the rights to private property, everything, all their issues and policies that they put forth in socialism takes that away, makes government the God, makes government the answer. Collectivism, everything the state runs and God is pushed out. And so that is what a lot of them are moving towards, and especially Bernie Sanders if he does win that nomination. So, you know, that is one issue that is extremely important that we open our eyes on. And, you know, it's been happening in the education system because they know that's where you get the future leaders of America, you know, in school. And we failed in that arena. We have failed to take that, as Lance Wallnau says, and, you know, be influencing that mountain of influence in education. And so, you know, we've got to start doing that. We've got to, you know, run for the school board or support those who's in the school board or local leaders that support conservative values of individual rights, of parental rights, and not enforce, you know, imposing government control over everything. So that is one issue that I definitely want to bring to the forefront. Okay, another issue that I'm going to go there, and it's a very difficult one to talk about because, for several reasons, because as Christians, you know, we're called to love our neighbor as ourselves, and we haven't always done that, and the ones that don't do it kind of get pushed into the forefront of the media of Christians are hateful, Christians are bigoted, because they want to stand on biblical principles. And this has been coming along for a couple of decades now, but it's really come to the forefront on the issue of homosexuality. And it is a very hard topic to talk about, mainly because of when you do stand on biblical principle, get media shamed. Anybody who stands on the traditional biblical viewpoint that marriage is between a man and a woman, they are immediately ostracized, shamed, called hateful, bigoted. It doesn't matter. And they just call all sorts of names. They don't want to talk about the actual topic or discuss it. And it's really hard to discuss that issue. And I kind of have to come at it a little different with as being a Christian. I see it as being two sides of a coin. And on one side of a coin is the personal level, where I have family members and I have friends who struggle with this, who live in that lifestyle. And it is on a personal level, I am called as a Christian to love the person, to, you know, always show Christ's love to them. Even though they know where I stand, I still can love on that person and pray for them. And because I don't care what the issue is, we all have a hole, a void in our lives that only Christ can fill. It's not filled by a husband or a wife or a relationship with any other person. It's only filled with Christ, and it's made that way. It's a God-given, a God-made void because he wants us to seek him for our identity. I don't care if it's anything where, whether you think you have to earn somebody's favor, or your identity might be in how good you are at work. Your identity could be how good you are at sports, especially for men who really are aggressive as far as competitive and things like that. They can put their identity in how well they do on a football field or a basketball court or a baseball field. And it doesn't matter where you put your identity. If it's not in Christ, you're going to have a void, and you're never going to be completely, fully abundant life. You won't have it. And so, but this issue of homosexuality and has been pushed to the forefront. And what I want to talk about is the other side of the coin, because as Christians, we are called to love the individual and the person. But on the other side of the coin, we are also are called to stand up and firm and be firm for our faith and our values, and to fight tyranny, I believe, which is tyranny is a kind of evil. And so we're to fight for freedom, and that includes religious freedom. And I'm going to bring to you some things and some stories that maybe you've not heard, because it doesn't really get talked about a lot. No matter where you turn, the 3-4% of our 320 million people, of those who say that they are, you know, homosexual, they are in the mountains of like media and entertainment and education, and you see it all the time now. Every time you turn the TV on, whether it's a show or an advertisement, so it makes you feel like everyone is for this, when it's really, that's not the truth. So I have researched a lot of different stories, and I'm gonna bring some information to you to really show you what the goal and the objective is for, I would call it, the more militant LGBT community and movement, because even they are not representative of all of the LGBT community. I know for a fact that there are many gay conservatives, and so they're not for the same thing that some of these other groups are trying to push, and that you see so that come across real real hateful. And so one of them, an issue, is last year the House passed the Equality Act, and it really wants it has to go back to the foundation of how they view why you are gay, I guess. And so this article talks about, in 2008, The Advocate, which is a leading LGBT news magazine in the U.S., ran a cover that starkly declared in all capital letters that gay is the new black. And it was a dramatic illustration of an assertion that has been at the heart of the LGBT rights movement, the idea that sexual orientation is immutable or incapable of change. So this new bill, the Equality Act, or really it's the Inequality Act, is a piece of legislation masquerading as civil rights protection that would actually increase inequality and harm women and children. And here's what's going on. The bill, it actually was passed, but has new life because the Democratic majority in the U.S. House, it would amend virtually every area of federal civil rights law to include sexual orientation and gender identity, not only in the area of employment, but also public accommodations, housing, credit, and a raft of other ideas. So they started with wanting equality, which we have already laid out in our Constitution. But what it's turned into is a specific, maybe turning it into equality for special, making them a special group with special privileges. The Civil Rights Act was a very needed thing because, you know, with the blacks, it was something that, you know, it's not like they were chose to be black. You know, it's very obvious if you're white or if you're black. It's a very obvious thing, and it's not something you can change. And so it was their part of the Civil Rights Act that had to be put into law in 1964. This law was passed at the height of the Black Civil Rights Movement of the 1960s in order to break the back of the pervasive Jim Crow racial segregation laws in the Deep South. Without much debate, Congress also prohibited discrimination based on sex. What both race and sex have in common is that they are inborn, involuntary, immutable, innocuous. And in the U.S. Constitution, none of these criteria apply to sexual orientation or gender identity. Yet the Equality Act would add these categories to federal law nonetheless. And that's what the House passed last year. This bill is based in part on the idea that any laws or practices which in any way disadvantage those who engage in homosexual conduct, from restricting their military service to defining marriage as a union of a man and a woman, to allowing religious schools not to hire or admit them, are inherently unjust because a person's sexual orientation, like their race, is fixed at or before birth and can never change. In 2015, the Supreme Court decision which redefined marriage to include same-sex couples, Justice Kennedy was explicit in declaring that his opinion rested on this premise. Only in more recent years have psychiatrists and others recognized that sexual orientation is immutable, Kennedy declared. Marriage is a fundamental right, and the petitioner's immutable nature dictates that same-sex marriage is their only real path to this profound commitment. Yet there is only one problem, the article goes on to say, about this immutability argument. The science shows it simply isn't true. And evidence shows, this article says, evidence shows sexual orientation can change, debunking the myth of immutability. I report on academic studies over the last two decades based on four large data sets drawn from surveys about sexuality. These studies are both population-based, which means they represent the population as a whole, and longitudinal, meaning they survey the same individuals at intervals years apart, so they can measure change over time. The truth is, sexual orientation is a multifaceted concept involving a combination of attractions, behaviors, and personal identity. These four studies all demonstrate that significant change in each of the elements of sexual orientation is possible. The percentage changing from homosexuality to heterosexuality ranged from 13 to 53%, while those changing from heterosexuality to homosexuality only ranged from 1 to 12%. In one survey of same-sex attracted respondents, up to 38% of men and 53% of women changed to heterosexuality in only a six-year period. So confirmation of this has come from a surprising source. Scholar Lisa Diamond, who herself identifies as a lesbian, has long studied and written about the sexual fluidity of women. In a 2016 article with her colleague Clifford Roski, she declared, "Given the consistency of these findings, it is not scientifically accurate to describe same-sex sexual orientation as a uniformly immutable trait." Some scholars on the left, including Diamond, still advocate for an LGBT political agenda, but they do so on the basis of arguments for personal sexual freedom rather than arguments about the nature of sexual orientation itself. However, this amounts to replacing an argument rooted in the principles of civil rights with an argument rooted in the principles of the sexual revolution. Totally different. In light of this evidence, the public would be wise to question whether the efforts of the LGBT movement to ride on the coattails of civil rights can any longer be justified. Indeed, the science shows that the evidence for immutability, on which many have relied to argue for such legislation, simply isn't there. So their goal really is, and they've said it themselves, is not just equality. It's to really silence the opposition. And in another article from a gay conservative, they said the Equality Act's blatant disregard for the basic right to religious freedom is appalling. The fairness for all, quote unquote, compromise, he was wanting, this article author is wanting a fairness for all kind of act, which I still am not. We already have fairness for all enshrined in the Constitution, okay? We don't need, except for the fact that we had, you know, the liberation for women, women's right to vote, and that kind of thing. So now we all have the equality, all right? The author is Brad Palumbo. He says the landmark LGBT rights bill, which is the Equality Act, is uncertain because it's, you know, passed the House, but it hasn't gone through the Senate yet. Even if it somehow could pass the Republican-controlled House Senate, President Trump would likely veto it. And that would be the right thing to do, he writes, no matter what the backlash. From my vantage point as a gay conservative, I can see that the Equality Act goes too far for any level-headed gay rights advocate to support, and its blatant disregard for the basic right to religious freedom is appalling. On the surface, well, because what it does, it's saying, oh, we just want, you know, no discrimination based on sex, sexual orientation, or gender identity in anywhere, public accommodations, facilities, education, federal funding, employment, housing, credit, juries, anywhere. They just don't want any discrimination. And on the surface, this sounds unobjectionable. Of course, nobody wants to face discrimination. Yet the bill defined public accommodations so loosely and called for regulations so sweeping that it would crush religious freedom and radically reshape American society. So I'm going to give you a couple of examples that are very interesting. And I'm going to play this video. You can't see it, but I will put the link to it on my page. And this lady runs Arlene's Flowers. Her name's Baronelle Stutzman. And this happened a few years ago, and not a whole lot of people probably heard about it. But this is what I'm talking about with their agenda to silence Christians, to crush religious freedom. And this is what all the those on the left are pushing. It's obvious because, you know, the Equality Act passed the Democrat-controlled House led by Nancy Pelosi. So I want you to listen to Baronelle and her story. It's just a few minutes. And I want you to hear her words and what is happening to different individuals across the nation because they stand for their religious freedoms.
I think the worst part is when they say, I won't serve gay people. That's just not true. I've never discriminated against anyone in my life. It was a Friday, March 1st, 2013. One of my favorite customers, Rob Ingersoll, walked into the store. Rob's more than a customer, he's a friend. He's been coming in to me for over 9 years for birthdays, anniversaries, Valentine's Day, Mother's Day. His arrangements were my favorite to design. They were really fun and challenging. We'd bounce different ideas around, and he'd let me be creative and produce something that was unique and special for him. Floral design is an art, and Rob gets that. I knew Rob would be coming in. He had been there the week before when I was out and told the staff that he and his longtime partner, Kurt, were getting married. I knew Rob would want me to create floral designs for their wedding. I love Rob, but I knew I couldn't do this. I'm a devout Christian. My relationship with Jesus Christ is the most important thing in my life. That's where everything I am and everything I have comes from, including my creativity. My faith also teaches me that marriage is a sacred union between a man and a woman. When the staff told me about Rob's visit, my husband and I talked and prayed about it. I would gladly sell him prearranged flowers or loose flowers, but I knew that as much as I love Rob, I could not create something to celebrate an event that was totally against my faith. I didn't want to hurt Rob's feelings, and I wanted to tell him as gently as possible. On that Friday, Rob came back. I took his hand in mine and told him I could not do his wedding because of my relationship with Jesus Christ. Rob said he understood and was very loving. We chatted as we always had. He talked about his mom walking him down the aisle, how we got engaged. Then Rob asked me to recommend another florist, and I recommended three that I knew would do him a good job. We hugged each other and Rob left. I was so thankful that Rob had graciously accepted my explanation and that we had parted as friends. Until a few weeks later, I got a letter in the mail from Washington State's Attorney General. The government was threatening to sue me unless I designed floral arrangements for same-sex weddings. I was in shock. It didn't seem possible to me that Rob would have filed a complaint, and he hadn't. The Attorney General saw a post Rob's partner had put on social media and decided on his own to threaten me, to take away my livelihood, unless I would create art for an event I didn't believe in. But I could never do that. I can't use the gift God gave me to violate my relationship with him. So the government and the ACLU sued my business and me personally for discrimination. My lawyers and I have been battling this case in court for 4 years. My case is simple. Will I serve gay customers? Yes, I served Rob joyfully for over 9 years and would welcome him back to my shop even now. Will I hire gay employees? Yes, and I have. Will I let the government force me to create art expressing things I don't believe in? No, and that's my right. That's every American's First Amendment right. What does freedom of expression mean if the government tells me how to express my art? What does freedom of religion mean if the government tells me I can't live out my relationship with Jesus Christ? If I lose in court, I will likely lose everything. The penalties and attorney's fees could be well over $1 million. My business would be gone. My husband and I would lose our home and our retirement. But I have faith. God gave me a gift. And I just want to continue serving him by using that gift to bring beauty and joy into people's lives. Rob and Kurt had the freedom to live their lives according to their beliefs. Should I not have that same right too?
That was the story of Baronelle Stutzman. She's not the only one. So here's another one. In January of 2015, after first meeting at a Bible study where they learned about their mutual passions for art, two young women met at a North Phoenix, Arizona Starbucks over tea and hot chocolate and hatched a plan to create and sell art together. They then quickly agreed to start a calligraphy and hand painting business. One of the girls was named Joanna and the other Brianna. They both got together and started Brush and Nib Studio, a for-profit art studio that creates hand-drawn invitations and paintings for weddings, businesses, and everyday moments. As Christian artists, Joanna and Brianna had a simple goal for their studio: to recreate the beauty God placed all around us and to share that beauty with others. And this goal made it natural for Joanna and Brianna to focus on artwork for weddings, one of the most beautiful days in someone's life. But this wedding focus drove Joanna and Brianna straight into a problem. Phoenix law required Brush and Nib to create and speak according to Phoenix's definition of marriage. As Joanna and Brianna were starting their business, they kept seeing news reports about authorities forcing Christians in the wedding industry to promote same-sex wedding ceremonies. Meanwhile, their friends began to ask them if Brush and Nib would promote same-sex wedding ceremonies. Then Joanna and Brianna saw the ensuing social media frenzy over the U.S. Supreme Court creating a constitutional right to same-sex marriage. They realized that they may not have the freedom to create art consistent with their artistic and religious beliefs. So they had to find out for sure. What they found was worse than they imagined. A Phoenix law required Brush and Nib to create invitations and other artwork for same-sex wedding ceremonies. It also prevented Brush and Nib from explaining to customers and the public why they could only create art consistent with their beliefs about marriage. And this law did all of this through criminal penalties. For each day that Joanna and Brianna followed their religious beliefs and disobeyed the law, they would each be penalized up to $2,500 a day and 6 months in jail. That left them with an impossible choice. They did not want to violate the law. They didn't want to go to jail and pay $2,500 for each day they failed to comply. They didn't want to close the business they poured so much of their heart and effort and work into. But the alternative wasn't doable. They could not compromise their artistic and religious beliefs. They could not accept sitting down in their studio and hand-drawing artwork that contradicted who they are and what they hold dear. They could not condone lying to customers or wasting customers' time, telling customers that Brush and Nib would create something it couldn't. And they could not stomach staying silent about the very beliefs that inspire their art. So their only viable option left was to go to Alliance Defending Freedom in 2016, and they filed a lawsuit on the behalf of Brush and Nibs against Phoenix. The lawsuit alleged that Phoenix is violating Joanna and Brianna and Brush and Nibs' rights under the Arizona Constitution and the Arizona Free Exercise of Religion Act by compelling them to create art they object to and by stopping them from discussing their artistic and religious beliefs with others. Thankfully, on September 26, 2019, so that was 3 years later, the Arizona Supreme Court ruled that the city of Phoenix cannot use a criminal law to force Joanna and Brianna to design and create custom wedding invitations. Such coercion, the court held, would violate the fundamental principle that an individual has autonomy over his or her speech and thus may be forced to speak a message he or she does not wish to say. So even though they won, they had to spend the time and the money and they had to not push, be able to do their business for 3.5 years. And they had to put all that on hold while they were in this lawsuit. So that's another example. There's one more that I found interesting. Three high school girls file a lawsuit to preserve fairness in women's sports. And this is going back to the Equality Act, which, again, the Democrat-led House has passed, and it's waiting for the Senate to go through. This is what it actually will do, okay? This is a great example of how it imposes upon women's rights, which is kind of ironic that the Democrats are all screaming about women's rights all the time, but they go and pass a law or a bill that really prohibits women's equality. And this story will tell about that. Three brave high school girls in Connecticut have done what many of their much older counterparts have been unwilling to do. They have asked the simple question, do female athletes deserve the right to compete on a level playing field? The answer should be common sense. That's why Title IX was created, after all, to provide women and girls with equal educational and athletic opportunities. But those opportunities are being stripped from these high school athletes, and now they're speaking out. You see, in 2017, they started facing a different kind of competition. That's the year that the Connecticut Interscholastic Athletic Conference changed its policies to allow male athletes who identify as female to compete as girls. That's why these three girls are taking a stand. Last year, they filed a complaint with the U.S. Department of Education, and while the Department of Education agreed to investigate this Connecticut policy, These female athletes are taking extra steps to ensure that the athletic opportunities of women and girls are preserved. Let me introduce you to these brave high school girls who have been personally harmed by being forced to compete against male athletes. Selena Soule, at the 2019 Indoor Track and Field State Championships, Selena finished one place away from qualifying for finals and two places away from qualifying for the New England Regional Championships in the 55-meter dash. But two of the sprinters that finished ahead of her, placing first and second, were male athletes. Because of that, Selena lost out on the opportunity to compete in front of college scouts at the New England Regional Championships. Instead, she had to sit on the sidelines. Then you have Alana Smith. In June of 2019, Alana won the 400-meter dash at the New England Regional Champions as a freshman. Thankfully, in that event, she had not been forced to compete against any male athletes, so she earned her rightful spot. But a male athlete did compete in and win the 200-meter dash. Alana placed third in that event instead of runner-up. Alana has a promising track career in front of her, but she knows that being forced to compete against male athletes could threaten her future opportunities to win championship titles and even earn scholarships. And then you have Chelsea Mitchell. Chelsea is one of the top female sprinters in Connecticut, but she has been denied the title of state champion four times because the CIAC, the Connecticut group, has allowed male athletes to compete as girls. Last year, she had the unexpected opportunity to compete on a more level playing field after a male athlete was disqualified for a false start. Chelsea went on to win the state championship and the New England Regional Championships in that event. So these three girls are not the only girls in Connecticut that have been impacted by this policy. In fact, two male athletes in Connecticut have taken 15 state championship titles that previously belonged to 9 different girls, and they have taken 17 individual meet records that previously belonged to 13 different girls. The reality is that there are significant differences between males and females. Comparably talented and fit males have more muscle mass, greater bone size, and even more heart and lung capacity, which makes them stronger and faster. The CIAC policy ignores this reality, and it is female athletes that are paying the price, losing out on championship titles, state records, and even scholarship opportunities. Girls like Selena, Alana, and Chelsea should be in the spotlight for their athletic talent and success. Instead, they have faced adversity from teammates and coaches simply for standing up for common sense. So that is one of the effects of this Equality Act that they don't tell you about very much about what happens. And we have to open our eyes. That's why I bring this to you, because we have to open our eyes to the truth of what really is going on with the things like the Equality Act and the Supreme Court decision to pass gay marriage, which really, you know, is that kind of thing should be left to the states. And what they're doing is overruling what the states passed in their own, you know, in each individual state. There are two other stories I want to just bring to the light here really quickly. One is about a guy in Atlanta, Georgia. His name was Kelvin Cochran, and he was a dedicated firefighter, 30 years of his life to fighting fires. And he actually was even appointed fire chief for the city of Atlanta in 2008. And his exemplary service record drew the attention of President Obama, who in 2009 appointed him the U.S. Fire Administrator for the United States Fire Administration. And he was actively involved in his Baptist church, where he's a deacon and leads a men's Bible study. But real quickly, what happened was he wrote a book, Who Told You That You Were Naked? And it was really addressed to the fallen nature and condition of manhood and encouraging men to fulfill their purpose as husbands and fathers. And in that book, of course, he promoted the biblical teaching that sex is reserved for a marriage between a man and a woman. And because of that statement, the city of Atlanta initially suspended him for 30 days without pay and ordered that he undergo sensitivity training. And an investigation revealed that he had not discriminated against anyone. And at the end of his suspension, he was fired. So he had to go to court. And in October of 2018, the city of Atlanta agreed to pay him $1.2 million in the wake of the federal court ruling that ruled that because he ruled that the city suspended and terminated Chief Cochran because he did not get permission from the city to write the book, a requirement that the court found to be unconstitutional prior restraint on speech. So that was one story. That's just some of the stories that I'm bringing to you that are, you know, important that we understand the agenda of what's going on with the extreme progressive radical parts of the left, and what we have to decide upon this election. And the last story I'll touch on really quickly concerns parents and parental rights. And it was in Wisconsin. And a group of parents found out that the school district in Madison in Wisconsin was quietly, very quietly, and not letting parents know that they implemented this policy that it's called... The school district believed that children can choose their own gender, and the school district was striving to, quote unquote, disrupt the gender binary. It actually would give lesson plans and books on letting children let them know that they can change their gender. That's really radical. Dr. Stephen Levine, a distinguished life fellow at the American Psychiatric Association, submitted an expert declaration to the court in this case. In his declaration, he said, for a child to live radically different identities at home and at school and to conceal what he or she perceives to be his true identity from parents is psychologically unhealthy in itself and could readily lead to additional psychological problems because they were telling kids not to tell their parents. They could live one way at school and another way at home. And he said it puts children on a potentially dangerous path, all without the knowledge of their parents. And he explains putting a child or adolescent on a pathway towards life as a transgender person puts that individual at risk of a wide range of long-term or even lifelong harms, including sterilization if they choose to do some type of chemical surgical change and associated regret and sense of loss, physical health risks associated with exposure to elevated levels of hormones, surgical complications, lifelong care, alienation of family, inability to form healthy relationships, and the list goes on. So this is still, parents. Some parents are pushing this agenda on their own kids, which is, in my view, very, very wrong. Kids at that age should not even be thinking of that kind of stuff. And he even says that research shows that a majority of children in several studies, a large majority who are diagnosed with what they call gender dysphoria, their gender dysphoria does not persist by puberty or by adult. And according to some recent studies, children who socially transition with the school's policy are less likely to achieve comfort living with a gender identity that they align or they try to choose. So it's very psychologically harming to children in that arena. But I read these stories because I want you to understand the difference. As a Christian, I am to love the individual. But you have to see as a group, as a whole, the militant side of this that's forcing and pushing an agenda on society, especially those who are call themselves Christians in business or in whatever it is that you do as a Christian, and their agenda is to really just to silence that. And look, you can even see it in Chick-fil-A and how they harassed Chick-fil-A for years. You can see it in, you know, it's called basically called corporate blackmail. You promote, you celebrate our lifestyle, or we will ruin your image, ruin your reputation. And some Christian businesses have been put out of business because of the legal fees of going to court. And just even you know, I've read only a few cases out of the dozens and dozens of cases that have happened, of active or are active or were active, you know, in defending their religious freedom. So I hope that I brought that information to you in a way that was very, well, just eye-opening. I'm hoping, as Christians, I keep emphasizing this, we are called to love people and not be hateful. It doesn't matter. I know that's what they want to call us, as hateful, bigoted people, for standing up for biblical values. And two people that really, really are a great example for me of showing Christ's love are my parents. And through the years, it doesn't matter who you are, where you've been, what you've done, especially with my mom, she can just walk up to anybody. And she so loves God that it just oozes out of her. And she's able to reach out and talk to people on a personal level and just show them God's love. And it's something that I aspire to do and be like, because she's a great example of how we show Christ's love. And so, you know, that's why I was bringing this to you. As Christians, we are to love, especially those around us and people that we know. And but at the same time, we have to, especially as Americans, fight for our freedoms, fight for our religious freedoms, our freedom to speak up, because it's not guaranteed for the next generation if we just sit here and do nothing. And you can tell, you can see it in society, the effects of when Christians are quiet. And so, you know, the progressive left has moved forward, and they're pushing their agenda, the socialist agenda, and anything that moves God out of the public square. And they want, you know, I just gave you some examples of that today. So I'm hoping this will help you think about who the candidates are as you come into this election season. Because it's so extremely important who we vote for. And I know there's a lot of Christians who say, well, I just, you know, Trump is just so, sometimes he just tweets some silly things and it just irritates me. Okay, I get that. Maybe that irritates you. But what is he actually doing? What are his actions saying? Because sometimes actions do speak louder than words, right? I think I've said that before. Yeah, everything he has done is to promote freedom, to promote faith, to promote God. If you haven't heard that, it's probably because the media is not telling you that. And, you know, he has done everything to promote individual freedom, promote America, jobs, economy, promote life. He is so pro-life. He's the most pro-life president since Reagan. And he is, just recently, he was able to, the Supreme Court upheld his executive action to defund Planned Parenthood from public, you know, from taxpayer money. And that was fabulous. That was a win for pro-lifers, okay? They don't need taxpayer money. They make enough money as it is without us paying it. And so he's doing a lot of things that are pro-family, God, life, America. And so okay, as a Christian, I have to look at that. I have to look at the actions, and I have to look at what actions the other side wants to bring for America and what they speak and what they say. And it's a little scary to me. So that's why I'm speaking out. And that's why it's so important for me to speak out and do this and bring you that information. And so if you still want to follow me, even after today, today's little controversial subjects, go to www.straighttalkwithmj.net. And also my Facebook page, my new Facebook page, Straight Talk with MJ. And remember, Straight Talk is one word with two T's. And so I really appreciate you all for listening and for following me. And get the word out, you know, share this with your friends. If they don't know about different candidates, maybe this will help them. And I'll always endeavor to bring that to you. And I know I didn't get to a history story today. I'm sorry, but I did run out of time. I will bring a good one to you the next time. But thank you for joining me, and God bless.